Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talk. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I'll talk to Dr. Akilah Carter-Francique, who is the executive director for the Institute for the Study of Sport, Society, and Social Change at San Jose State University. She's also an associate professor in the Department of African American Studies, and her scholarly endeavors and field of focus encompass the intersections of sport, society, and social justice. Dr. Akilah was also on season 2, episode 12 of Tucker Center Talk. So welcome back, Dr. Akilah.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's so great having you back on Tucker Center Talks. For those who missed the Tucker Center Distinguished Lecture Series, Dr. Akilah and four of her fantastic, fierce female colleagues were panelists on voices of resistance of Black women in activism and in sport in particular. And I wanted to invite her back, and we're doing a podcast series of all the panelists separately because some of the feedback we got was every single one of these amazing women needs their own distinguished lecture and their own platform and their own podcast. So we are going to dive deep and go more in depth with some of the points that Dr. Akilah made and answer some audience questions that we didn't get to that night. So are you ready to dig in?
I am ready. Thank you.
So much to unpack in so little time. But for those who didn't watch the webinar yet, we will have a link to it in the show notes. And you can also find it on the tuckercenter.org on our website. It's free. It's fantastic. It's jam-packed full of great scholarly information. And one of the things that Dr. Akilah and I are going to talk about that really resonated with attendees are the way she framed rage and Black rage and Black female rage. And one of the most impactful pieces of the distinguished lecture was when you were the lead off speaker and you started with a video and song called Black Rage by Lauryn Hill. And that was just a punch in the face. So tell me how you decided to frame your remarks with a framework of rage, and you use Black feminist scholars over the years to help you do that. I thought it was really an interesting framework. So tell us about that.
I think that's a great question. One of the things that always moves me and I think helps me kind of work through a lot of challenges is music. Is song to really help me unpack. And in many ways, music, particularly, you know, when I think about our Black women singers and artists, is a story, you know, and speaking for our community. If we, you know, go back and think about Nina Simone, she has just been a muse in so many different ways, but has really been a voice of the people during those particular time periods. As I, you know, even move through my own development and coming of age, you know, women that spoke to me that were musicians were Jill Scott, were Erykah Badu. And as I sort of presented here, Lauryn Hill. And so I, you know, was thinking about this conference and sort of, or this lecture series and what I wanted, which could be a conference, but this lecture series and really what I wanted to share. And I think it was just trying to, in many ways, be a voice of Black women and Black women in society, but even in the space of sport, in many ways, I think sort of springboarding off of my keynote address last year at NASS, you know, living at the intersection is so interesting, you know, being a woman, being of color, being on the margins in so many different spaces. And I would say I've been blessed by hearing the voices of students, being there to be a shoulder to cry on for, you know, colleagues, being a soundboard, and at the same time, them allowing me to do that same thing. And so what I've heard in all of these different spaces is just frustration, not being heard. You know, we talked about those things of being invisible and silenced. And so in this moment, when we talk about the racial unrest that's happening in the country, when we think about, you know, Breonna Taylor and those types of things, just it really just spoke to me. And so Lauryn Hill, I think, released a song a few years ago that talks about Black rage and really just trying to explain to the masses where our frustration, our anger, our anxiety, our rage comes from, is from this historical mistreatment, being marginalized, experiencing disenfranchisement, being those that have suffered at the hands and not being heard in many ways through microaggressions, macroaggressions, you know, ways that we're treated within various institutions, to include politics, to include our justice system, to include education. And so it really just kind of spoke to me in this space of sort of using that as a muse. And then, interesting enough, just being one that is you know, studies Black women in sport, utilizing the work of Audre Lorde, utilizing the work of bell hooks, you know, really started to bring those things together synergistically. In particular, bell hooks is something I read back during my doctoral studies, this notion of killing rage. And I read it and I didn't really understand it then until I started to live through life a little bit more and have some experiences that was, you know, that helped me understand, okay, that's what it is I'm going through. Mm-hmm. And so Lauryn Hill served as a muse in many ways, but it brought together, I think, the voices of the Black female collective, mm-hmm. and really understanding what is this notion of rage consist of. And as I said, you know, rage is defined as violent, uncontrollable anger, but anger is defined as a strong feeling of displeasure and usually of antagonism. So just understanding within that, Lord even suggests it's bound in this concept of race and racism, right, and what you express. Yeah.
And I think you bring in Lauryn Hill, you bring in Audre Lorde, bell hooks, Brittany Cooper, mm-hmm. back to Lorde, you know, in different ways how they use rage to frame how they're thinking about their own lived experiences as mm-hmm. Black women. And then you take a turn and you say you have your own definition of rage. So share that with us. How you are seeing it,
you know, understanding, and I think that's what it is going through some of my studies and my own lived experiences and coming to an understanding of what it means, again, to live at the intersections, but to experience racism, to experience sexism and other isms in between. I've utilized, I guess, that rage in many ways to serve as a space where I can sort of cultivate knowledge. You know, Lorde says that this notion of anger is information because of how you're mistreated. So you're learning from those experiences. We're beginning to get an understanding of what some of those challenges are. And what I begin to see is that I begin to carve out a space in my work to write, and to write in a way that it served as a form of resistance. And so I said this resistance against generational miseducation, because in many senses is that, and I think as we're learning now in this confluence of COVID-19 and racial unrest, a number of deficiencies of miseducation that's taking place where people don't truly understand, well, why are people upset? Well, I didn't know I was behaving this way. And so in many respects, it is a miseducation because some of those truths, those lived experiences have not been written in books, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to add to the context and add to our full understanding of the human experience, the experience of Americans, all Americans in this space, or those across the world, to know what it means to be marginalized, to understand, you know, racist acts. And so unpacking these lived experiences to really work towards imparting knowledge to groups and subgroups to help them understand these are our challenges. And so we need to know our history. We need to use that to understand the present and then ultimately take all of those energies to create action, positive action for the future.
One of the questions that we didn't get to that I thought was interesting, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is, like we said, you mentioned a lot of different kinds of rage in your talk, killer rage and eloquent rage and healing rage. And the question was, do you think that we're seeing or will see a new kind of rage as Black female athlete activism progresses? Like, are we going to have a new...
This notion of rage is steeped in anger and frustration, I think of anxiety. I don't necessarily see a new form of rage. My goal and my hope by sort of illuminating this notion is that it will allow groups, organizations, people to provide concessions to have people feel, to allow Black women to feel and mm-hmm. be able to go through that full range of feeling and emotion such that they can, you know, feel more human in these spaces and times. You know, we allow concessions for other experiences and lived experiences for different groups of people, but it seems in many ways as Black women, we've been told that we can't share that side of ourselves. We have to go back home, kind of deal with it. And that's one of the things I wanted, you know, to express is that that happens in many respects in the world of sport too. You know, mm-hmm. If you lose, just grace and defeat.
Yeah, suck it up.
Yeah. And so we've been taught that. So we have that sort of, you know, intersection and compoundedness of, you know, you're a professional, you're also a Black woman. And in many ways, we know about the stereotypes of Black women. And one of those is being the angry Black woman. So right. If I was to get upset over something that truly justified a mistreatment on me, but do it in a public space, that controlling image, that stereotype would come forth, and that begins to precede us in those different spaces and places, as opposed to saying, well, what you did to her was wrong, so she's justified in her feelings. But, you know, those are things that we as Black women are oftentimes having to navigate all the time and mm-hmm. be, you know, go high, as Michelle Obama would say.
Absolutely, go high.
Yeah.
So one of the comments from the audience too, when you're talking about activism and anger as healing mm-hmm. and as a source of anger as a source of empowerment, one of the attendees said, I don't know if anger should ever be used as a source of empowerment. So how would you counter that? What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts were that I hear what they're saying. I want to acknowledge that. But one of the things in articulating this full message is that, again, as Black women, if we are allowed to go through the full range of human experience. And so I sort of bring in this notion, which again, I wasn't able to unpack on that show. We had so much to put in there, but I wanted to get to was thinking about, you know, the grief model. Mm. You know, when we experience death or loss, there is this a model, Kubler-Ross talks about it, this grief model. And in that, it's the different phases are shock, denial, frustration, depression, experiment, decision, integration. I've also heard it as, again, that shock and denial, anger, depression and detachment, dialogue and bargaining, acceptance, and then this notion of empowerment. But in this space, when we talk about rage, again, connecting it with anger, that's the second stage. Once we've learned of something, once we've seen an injustice, experienced an injustice, we go into that shock and I can't believe this just happened. In some respects, in other respects, it's not again. So that anger begins to steep, but we oftentimes live in that space of anger. Or if we're not in that anger space, we may drop to that space of depression. And, you know, if we look at mental health statistics, Black women have high statistics when it comes to depression and anxiety. And so we're living in that space a lot of our life and in some of these working environments as well. But if we're allowed to go through that human emotion experience, and move through the shock and denial and the anger, move through and navigate through that depression, and come out of it on the other side towards a space of empowerment, we can begin to use those energies, those lived experiences, not necessarily to accept what had happened, but to understand and how to better navigate the road ahead, such that we can step into those activist roles or whatever platform serves us well, be it educator, be it researcher, be it athlete, you know, to promote safe spaces, to educate young groups, to inform others about the challenges, or to, again, use our purpose, if you will, fulfill our purpose to be, you know, productive citizens of this particular space. But we've got to move through those spaces. And that oftentimes are different working environments, society sometimes will not allow that opportunity. And so we're kind of in that space of not really wanting to move. Some of us have been able to navigate. We may still have that frustration and things seeping in us, but we're able to, in many ways, wear the mask and pivot to continue to push through. Right. But we have a better understanding of those injustices have taken place and can hopefully share out with others to step into those activist roles, whether it be to promote voting rights as we have coming up here.
Mm-hmm. And that you and I are talking on the eve of the 2020 US election. So
yes,
that's a whole different podcast.
A whole different podcast, but I think in many ways connected because of who's on the ticket. And the experiences that she's going through in this space and time. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the idea of framing anger as a human condition and emotion that we all should have the freedom to express and feel and not deny as a path to grieving and human functioning and empowerment, I think is a good way to answer the criticism that anger should never be used as a source of empowerment. And you know, I don't know who asked that question. It's really not important, but you know, we also have to examine our own positions of privilege that we can say, oh, yeah, well, you shouldn't use anger as a source of empowerment because anger is dangerous and violent or whatever your preconceptions are. So
right.
I think that's another piece of that as well.
Yeah, because I think, you know, what's tapped in there and some of the models that I see, you know, talk about anger as frustration, anxiety, irritation, embarrassment and shame. And so those things are muddled in there. And when you've been in spaces and places where you are, you know, sharp as a tack, got your doctorate, you know, you're presenting well, but someone makes a comment that really invalidates your purpose for being there, the information you shared as a Black woman, you know, or even just as an individual expert, that is a normal human emotion that we should, you know, you're living through. So to just say, hey, ignore those feelings, you're imagining things is something that we're oftentimes having to reckon with. I know that I've lived through it in many different spaces and places. I know our panelists have gone through that as well. Mm-hmm. But I think many of you all out there in the audience have had situations where people sort of discount your feelings in a certain situation. And so that frustration seeps in, or, you know, some sort of embarrassment or shame may come from that. But we've got to, at some point, continue living and continue moving through. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I think you spoke to that even at the beginning of our podcast of have grace. And that's what, you know, we are hoping that as humans, we are allowed grace to have feelings and emotions that, you know, will take us to certain places, but that we need sometimes space and time to move through that and just, you know, allow everyone that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to reverse course here. I'm going to ask you your advice to young scholars, and then we'll end with talking about what's going on at the center, all the good work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Because I think some of the questions that came in from probably graduate students who are out there in their lonely graduate spaces doing their dissertations, feeling rage and anxiety and all the anger and in this current time we're in, and they were looking for some insight and advice as young women, as young Black women or women of color. What advice would you give them?
Well, first and foremost, as a PhD student, stress and anxiety are real. It's part of our lived experience. I can't even get past that. Just, you know, you're learning new words, you're learning terminology. I in particular was studying, you know, Black women in sport, and much of, to go back to the point about this notion of miseducation, some of the stuff I hadn't learned about and really understood about the lived experiences of Black women. I know when I read Bell Hooks' Ain't I a Woman, and learned about, again, women on that slave trade piled one on top of the other. Some of them were with child. Some of them have been raped in that process. It just kind of, it angered me in many ways. And so I needed time to process that information. But as I say that, you know, with respect to my own studies, even at dissertation, some of the mystery of it, the mystery of the process, if we can unveil some of those, that will help get some of that anxiety. Mm-hmm. But the other is truly, you know, we are few and far between in some of these programs. And so you do feel like you're alone. And, you know, one of the things that I did as a doc student was connect with student groups on campus. And so we had a graduate and professional group at University of Georgia called GAPS. And Black students, they were masters, they were PhDs. And I went to those meetings and met other students. And so on the monthly meetings that we had, or the occasions that we met, but I also found a group as well that were in some of the classes that I took. And so we would meet up, you know, twice a week and write together and kind of talk about our work, even though we were in different fields. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me through that. So it was finding community and going to these spaces and places. For some, it may be a cultural center to be able to identify those spaces, but that was really of help. I sought out Black professors that may not have been in my space, you know, as far as my field of study. Of course, I had, you know, Dr. Hawkins, who was my chair, Rose Thompson, who was on my committee as well, who's part of our sport community. Mm-hmm. But I had those that were, you know, other professors throughout the university whose classes I ended up taking, but also, you know, just spent the time to, hey, can I come see you for office hours? Just to either share work or just to be able to share, mm-hmm. you know, who I was. So that really helped. Another thing that was very helpful was going to our parent discipline as far as conference. So NASS, you know, North American Society for the Sociology of Sport, which...
of which you are the past president of.
Yes, yes. And that was a place that really nurtured me. I met some amazing scholars. Some were former athletes, which really helps in many ways sort of validate and move me through this space of imposter syndrome as well. you know, as a student athlete, because we're told, you know, that dumb jock scenario, and it even in many respects applied to women. And so NASS was very helpful in that I met other students that we're studying, who have become my sister docs. And we created spaces to where we would go to each other's sessions. And I'm happy to say this is year two, but we're holding another session this week. And it's going to be entitled Four Women, again, using the musings of Nina Simone's Four Women, to have a session to bring women of color, Black women together, to know that there's a community here for you. We may be one off at every institution, and that's pretty much, you know, the sort of the nature of academe in many ways.
Absolutely, but, yes.
Yeah, but that there's a community. So picking up a phone, I'm very old school, pick up a phone and call. We are here. Send an email. We are here. And that's what the NASS community did for me, and sending me texts as I was going through my schooling, or just, you know, we would connect and just be on the phone. How are things going? Mm-hmm. How are you? And so it's going to be partly, you know, as young women, I would say, reaching out and stepping out to find community, and in others, you know, to in many ways sort of understand some of the work that you're going to go through will be on your own, which is the nature of a scholar in many senses. So just finding that community.
It's a lonely life.
It is. It is. And you're in your head a lot. So, yes, you know, when you can find those moments, and find those communities within your university and beyond, that will be great. And like I said, NASS helped sustain me not only during my doctoral studies, but as I've moved each year, you know, through this process of being an academic.
It's interesting, Dr. Akilah, because when I talked with Dr. Jasmine and then Dr. Joyce, who were also on the panel with you for the distinguished lecture, their advice was eerily similar. So Jasmine says, you know, find your people. Mm-hmm. Right? And she has a group of her own sister docs that she calls the dolls.
Okay.
That were seven Black women getting their PhDs all at the same university in the same program, which was historic.
Yes.
And then Dr. Joyce talks about, you know, finding community and building that sisterhood and finding your people. So, you know, I think sometimes when we're giving advice to young women, it's like, wow, you got to network and you got to find community. We're actually really serious that this serves a very positive function,
yeah,
that shouldn't be taken lightly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one where we met each other during NASS, I would say, this group. We were at different stages, and so we were able to help each other navigate through the different stages, not only of schooling, but of life. So, you know, we've gone on, some of us have found partners, had little ones. Trying to navigate homeschooling right now has been interesting. But even just, you know, what recipe should I use? Because I've got this going on this week and I can't cook every night, you know? So some of things are very kind of what may seem simple, but I'm like, they're kind of life lessons to support us. In many ways, I kind of go back to my athlete self, of that everybody hasn't really been a student athlete before. And so nobody knows except for somebody else that's been an athlete to kind of how to find that quote unquote balance. And so speaking to them just provides peer mentorship in many ways. You know, we're helping one another through this. But in many ways too, again, it speaks back to the community culture of Black women, where we are a very collectivist culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we thrive and nurture and support and, you know, serve as family to one another in these spaces and times. And that's what we mean by, you know, find your community or find your people. Because I think just in life in general, as you're going through, we always sort of have our little core group that, that helps us get through every moment. And so that's so important. And it's been very important and significant in my journey. And in many ways, I will say I wouldn't make it here without them. And not only my sister docs, but I have to give a shout out to my brother docs, you know, that have definitely supported me through these times. And, you know, I do my best to support them because life, again, this notion of human emotion and the full range of life happens. You know, yes, this is what we do, but we have a greater purpose, you know, on this great earth here, I believe. And so we've got to be able to express that and allow ourselves, again, grace such that we can fulfill that life purpose.
Yeah. And before we hit record, you were telling me that there's a lot of young women across the country and different disciplines who are finding their way to you because of the work you do and because you're visible and you have a voice and you're a lighthouse for them. And that's just one of the ways of all the good work that you're doing at the center is it provides a platform and a space and visibility for you so you can provide that mentorship for others. So tell us about some of the work that's going on at the center right now.
Oh my goodness. So yes, the Institute for Sport, Society, and Social Change started in 2017 at San Jose State University with the architect, Dr. Harry Edwards, you know, creating this space. I was just onboarded last year as the executive director. Again, another first in the sense of first for me to kind of assume a role like this, but I think one of the first Black women over a sport institute. It's been challenging in many ways because, you know, who's the lighthouse for me, you know? So part of that kind of comes in, but in many ways, being supported to say, you know, you've done some of the work. So just kind of trust your gut in some of this. But I will say, you know, it's the support of a team as well. You know, we have a small team, but it's not just the team, it's the board that we have. It's the faculty affiliates that are involved with it as well to make it come to fruition. And so the first year has been very interesting because
steep learning curve.
It is a steep learning curve because it first came moving from Texas, from Prairie View A&M University to, you know, California was a part of the curve, was just kind of a cultural shift. Weather shift into this space, but then, you know, coming on and COVID happening. So, yeah, trying to get your feet wet and understand what's going on with the Institute in and of itself and, you know, who we can work with and correspond with. And then, you know, this comes. And one of the things, you know, I think that's been a beautiful thing with COVID coming on. I know we can't, you know, it's maybe hard for some to find some of that, has been being in this virtual space. Mm-hmm. We would not be able to connect with half the communities, I think, if we weren't in a virtual space. And the community meaning not only our local regional areas, but you know, across the globe, we've been able to connect with some great people. So one of the first things that we did is that we shifted into a virtual platform and started a webinar series called Sport Conversations for Change, where we wanted to bring forth just some issues that I think we as scholars were talking about amongst ourselves. And I was thinking, I'm like, well, this is great information, but the people that need it are, you know, boots on the ground and they don't have time. So let's find, you know, a place where we can talk about these issues, acknowledge what they're going through. And in many ways, in our communities, we were sort of troubleshooting some of these issues and giving best practices and resources so they could just tap into them and get that nugget and point and click and go to where they needed to go. So we had conversations because, again, COVID was only going to be an 8-week thing that we thought.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But little did we know, you know, it was going to be longer. But even in having those conversations, just the richness that came from it, people and experts sharing their insight, sharing their own experiences, again, sharing best practices as it relates to managing women in sport in this time frame, how to support high school athletes that season wasn't postponed because they have to still graduate. It's a different lived experience, sporting experience for a high school athlete than a college. So how do we best support them? At the same time, being able to sort of glean some hope or some ways to manage from our Olympians whose, you know, Olympics was postponed. So we shared those stories. And the, you know, then most recently, we've continued. So we started our fall series and we opened up with the conversation about representation matters, really to unpack these issues of race and racism in sport and even higher education. So we had some great, you know, speakers and experts on there, written many, you know, books and contributed to the conversation as well. And then our October show was on Americans with Disability Act. So to again, to understand that, you know, we are in this space of racial unrest right now. But I think one of the things that's a light has been shined on a number of challenges that organizations are going through, to include not only racism, but sexism. You know, but, you know, issues of disability, not only physical disability, but learning disabilities. How are we managing, for example, our student athletes that have learning disabilities in this virtual time right now?
Right.
So they can get the support that they need. And so all of that and the interactions and the great collaborations we've had to include Tucker Center that we've had in those conversations have also pushed our institute to bring things together. And so next week, November 12th and 13th, we will be launching our inaugural conference. So our Sports Society and Social Change Conference that is titled or thematically titled Reimagining Sport in the Age of COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter. So what we're bringing together in this 2-day event is an opportunity for groups, organizations, athletes, parents, those that support sport as engagement to come into this space, hear from thought leaders, researchers, scholars, what I'm calling change agent organizations, so organizations that have been doing the work, boots have been on the ground, to support other sport organizations to come and speak, and to also, you know, really thoughtfully go through some workshops to talk about. We have 3 workshops that we're going to focus on. One is on race and gender, one is on the athlete experience, and the other is on diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we can come in that space, hear some of the research, the history, understand the importance and significance, and then help organizations work through whatever challenges they're facing to reach a better space for their stakeholders, for their athletes, for their employees, you know, that they work in that space. And lastly, I'll say we're having a space to really spotlight our students. One of the things that we at the Institute really embrace and understand is that when we talk about social change, when we talk about social justice and activism, in many respects, you know, we may not live to see the fruits of our efforts. And so there's a need to continue dialogue. And I'm going to use the world of track and field as a metaphor, because that was my sport, but to pass the baton to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And so this is a space where we definitely want to highlight our young people and continue to encourage them to get involved in activism and use their platform, their education to promote social change in these days and times. And they can do it. You know, they are yes. so I've had an opportunity to work with some of these great students. Some of them are our very own interns at the Institute. Mm-hmm. And they've just I'm blown away. I'm so impressed. And I'm so, again, empowered and excited by their energy that they leave me hopeful for the future to come.
That's one of my favorite parts about my role in the Tucker Center is getting to work with our interns and my Tucker team and our grad students, because they bring me energy and creativity mm-hmm. and insight. And as you were talking, I was just looking through the lineup for the conference. And for those who might be listening to this podcast after the conference has concluded, will you be recording because the lineup you have here is second to none. I mean, oh my gosh.
Yes. So we are going to be recording the majority of the conference. So all okay. of our keynote sessions will be recorded. Our change agent organizations that we are highlighting in that space will be recorded. Mm-hmm. The student presentations will report out, because basically those students are going to have opportunity. They're presenting and they're putting their presentations in a digital platform that we'll host on YouTube. Okay. And then, so we're going to spend that 45-minute window discussing the work, the innovation, the entrepreneurship, the foresight that they have with their work that they're doing in that space. And then we'll close with a town hall that will also be recorded. Okay. One of the things that we wanted to do is not record the words to action. Those are the breakout groups. Then, mm-hmm. and in many ways, those are the, workshops where individuals can come and bring forth their individual or their organizational challenges and talk about them in a real way. I'm so excited because they're going to be led by some amazing scholars that have written books on it, on these different areas when it comes to, race and sport, or are leading centers on gender and sport, and have developed models when we talk about the athlete experience, or are at the, the fore of thought when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so we really want organizations and those individuals, those people in those organizations, to bring their full self into the space to listen, learn, share, network, vent in some ways. But again, acknowledge that. One of the things that I've spoken to everybody that's a part of this is to know that, we may not have all the answers, and that's okay, but we need to start talking about it, having dialogue, troubleshooting, because some of us may be at different stages again and can support one another through this process. We are having a truly, life-changing experience as not only a sport community, but a global community. Mm-hmm. And this is a space where we want to, in many ways, just support each other through this process and continue to support. And so that's what we want to do with this conference, is to support. But again, how can we reimagine sport? How can we create and innovate and do something anew in this space to continue to engage, continue to uplift, and continue to celebrate what sport can do mm-hmm. in our society?
Well, I personally am very excited for your conference. I get the privilege of being on one of your panels.
Yes, and we are so excited to have you.
And I know I will learn a lot. And for those who are tuning in after the fact, please do check out the Sport Conversations for Change and the upcoming conference from the Institute, and all the good work that Dr. Carter Francique and her colleagues are doing. And thank you so much for being on Tucker Center Talks again. I really do appreciate all the good work you're doing, and I look forward to some future collaborations as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy holidays from Wisp Sports.
So as we wrap up this episode of Tucker Center Talks, I'd love to hear from you. So you can tweet me at Dr. Sports Psych or at Tucker Center. You can be sure to check out the many free resources that are evidence-based on our website at tuckercenter.org. You can find the show notes with links and resources to this episode at wisports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows how turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes so aglow will make it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. Loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh, and every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeers really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer